Classic Logistics Computer Systems and Inland Transportation. They have ordered 12 new vessels that are the 5,500 TEU class. What Mr. Wakabayashi is saying is that there is a limit to vessel size in many of the markets, and you have to consider all of the factors when you take into consideration vessel size. The 5,500 TEU size that he's referring to is essentially that size which Evergreen was bringing to Portland and made a decision, now to discontinue service in June. We see that as probably the upper limit of vessels that will conceivably come into the Portland market in the foreseeable future. We started this study over 10 years ago. We still believe that for the economics of matching size with the other logistics and particularly the market here, we think that we're serving a niche that this channel project will carry us well into the future on.
Mr. Ringo.
Thank you. Part of the benefit from the port is jobs in Portland, and part is jobs in the rest of the part of the state, the grain that you mentioned. And I'm wondering if you can give me some sort of estimate as to which part benefits more. Is it in terms of jobs? If we increase the depth by 3 feet, are you going to have some job creation in Portland, but more in other parts of the state? Any?
Chair, I'll try to answer the question, Representative Ringo. First of all, we have done a lot of review of what the job implication is, and there will be others specifically. Mr. Witt will give you some comments specifically about job numbers. I can give those also, but I know he was planning to cover that. I would let him do that, but I'd be happy to tell you that we've also done the studies. I think the important thing to consider when we look at this project, it's not so much a question of trying to develop new jobs. What we're really concerned about is retaining first and foremost what we've got. When Delta Airlines left Portland earlier this year, with that went some jobs, and with that went opportunity. And what we're talking about in this project, first and foremost, is retaining what we've got, keeping the access that Oregon shippers have today, and that's at stake. So if you say that 1 in 4 jobs or 1 in 5 jobs in the metropolitan area, whatever the number is you want to use, and I think it's probably in the Multnomah County, Tri-County area, Clark County is probably more in the 1 to 4, could be as much as a couple hundred thousand jobs in some way or another are touched by what goes on in terms of sea trade, or trade in general. Then what you're talking about is creating an environment that will keep those job opportunities in place. Going to the future, I think much of the growth depends upon strategies that we take and efforts we put forth, such as the gypsum plant and the ethanol plant in the St. Helens area. Those are examples of new opportunities that are waiting to basically materialize, depending upon whether or not the transportation system is in place. So I hope I've given you some flavor. We're really talking about trying to keep what we've got first and foremost, and then build an environment that will allow for meeting Oregonians' needs in the future.
Representative Johnson, or Senator, you had a question.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for your presentation. Mike Solon and I went back a long ways when he was chairman of Ways and Means, sitting where Chair Butler is sitting, and he always told me, keep your powder dry. And all the time I thought it was face powder. I didn't know it was gunpowder. But I have a question.
Senator, you, I paid up. Please let me off the hook.
So my question is pretty much the same as Representative Johnson's question. I want to know what's your 5-year plan. I mean, once you deepen the channel in 5 years, what's your plan to be competitive?
Chair, Senator Yee, if I understand the question you're asking, Senator Yee, you're asking me what is the Port of Portland's plan to continue to be a competitive port if assuming the channel project goes forward?
Yes.
So much of what we do at the port reflects what happens in the state of Oregon. As I commented in some of my numbers, who would have thought several years ago when we were talking about grass straw and what do you do with it, that the solution would come about eventually because you had an efficient transportation system that allowed that product to go to a market in Japan or a market in Korea and be used in the feed chain and do it in a way that was economically feasible. So what I'm suggesting is, in answering the question, the port is not going to drive the economic behavior of the state of Oregon. But I can assure you this, to the extent that we provide good access, that we collectively provide good access, the economic future of the state of Oregon will continue to be positive and bright. Now, we see some specifics that in an attempt to answer your question that I think are pretty realistic to look at. I mentioned the bulks, both grain and fertilizer products and other bulk materials. We will continue to, because of our superior rail service in the Columbia River system, we will continue to be a very strong port area that will continue to attract those kinds of investments that depend upon having access to both rail and water, or good water, rail, and surface road transportation. We've got land capacity in the greater Columbia River reach to continue to provide new opportunity. So our business plan really is to make sure that we're providing the services that this state needs, and we try to monitor that on a close basis. We're going to do what we can to make sure we serve the niche market that exists in the agricultural areas through containers, particularly some of the high value food processing, fruits and vegetables and those sort of things. And so our plan reflects what it is that the state sees as its opportunity, recognizing the one element we provide is good transportation connections. If we don't provide that, the rest of this doesn't work. As I'm sure you know, in a dynamic global marketplace, if you can't get to the marketplace, you can't compete, and you will not be successful.
Mike, from your previous remarks, you're saying you're not going to come back and ask us to deepen the channel again once you deepen the channel this time.
Based on the study, Mr. Chair, Senator, based on the study we've done and based on what we know today, and given the dynamics of the Columbia River Shipping Channel, it's our best estimate that we believe that this project, the 43 project, when combined with the tidal impact and the fact that 9 to 10 months out of a normal year, there's more water in the river than even at the 43-foot level because of runoff and other stream flow. In the normal part of the year, there's probably 45 feet of water or more today. What we have is obviously in the low water season and a year like this when we're faced with drought, when we really hit those limits. When you take all those factors into play and consider the tidal implication, there's a 2-foot tidal implication that comes as far up as Portland as a result of ocean tidal event. You combine all those factors and then look at the market, we believe that 43 feet will provide us the opportunity we need to serve the state's interests well into the future. And I do believe, and I've talked with the carriers to a great extent, that at some point this great race to make mega ships is going to come face to face with the fact that in this country we do not have the infrastructure in place to accommodate the kinds of vessels that are coming. And at some point, a $150 million investment in a mega-sized container ship comes face to face with the fact that if it's tied up at a dock for a week while all the containers are being taken off and they're waiting for trains to move out because of congestion, the economics of the mega ship doesn't wash. That's an opportunity that I think plays well for the Columbia River region, and why I think our size with this channel size should serve us well. And Mr. Wakabayashi didn't say this because I told him to say it. He said it because he felt it. And I'm sure you know K-Line is one of the three major Japanese carriers. So, you know, life is always full of challenges. You look to the future and you make your best call and you say what will work. And we think this will work given the cost and the benefit and what we think the market to be.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, actually. You've mentioned a couple of times in your presentation two facilities that have gone into my district, or one contemplated, one in, the USG facility and the ethanol plant. I've been fairly close to those sites, and it seemed to me that those companies made the commitment to build despite channel deepening, because at the time that they were contemplating siting there, it was access to the water that was important to them, not necessarily the depth of the channel. Do you have any reaction to that?
No, Representative Johnson, I'm well aware of the fact that they've made decisions to move forward given the situation that exists today. I also believe that they are aware of the fact that there is a project which, particularly in the USG case, will make the costs of their moving their products substantially, the unit costs substantially less, because their vessels that bring in the product are draw deeper draft vessels. So this will help their economics. But you're right, the channel project per se, to my knowledge, and I was not involved in negotiating any of those deals and didn't talk to them directly from that perspective, but the fact is there is a shipping channel, and because there is a shipping channel and they need vessel draft or vessel access capability, made it more feasible for them to locate there.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Paula.
As you know, because we've talked about this any number of times, my district encompasses that piece of the Columbia River that goes all the way from the mouth into Portland, not completely into Portland, but most. One of the things that my constituents share with me is the absence of sort of alternative analysis. How thoroughly were any other options for development at Astoria discussed? And the other option that I'm much closer to was the question of Port Westward. Just for the benefit of anybody listening to this who doesn't know Port Westward, it's a 940-acre site that's right on the Columbia River. It's an old World War II munitions plant that has sat largely idle since World War II, with the exception of a PGE power-generating facility there. It's served by rail, albeit somewhat shaky rail that could profit from substantial improvement. But I know from my experience as a port commissioner on the Port of St. Helens that when the port began seriously exploring loop rail in that site and the possibility of handling grain operations, that there was some pushback from the Port of Portland. And I'm curious to have your opinion on how much exploration of alternatives to deepening the channel with other industrial sites that could serve as alternatives to a $200 million and growing channel deepening project fraught with controversy.
Well, let me just say that the cost of the project is not necessarily growing, and I don't know that it's fraught with controversy. It's going through a process to satisfy and answer questions that have been raised relative to making sure the project can go forward without doing damage to endangered fish species. And that's been a part of the review that's gone on from the beginning. So the alternatives analysis, a part of the feasibility study, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, was basically conducted with an alternatives analysis as a part of it. Astoria was looked at and dismissed rather quickly because, quite candidly, there's not the land space there to accommodate the alternatives. And when you're looking at the alternatives, this is not just a Port of Portland alternative. You have to look at the Port of Vancouver, the Port of Kalama, the Port of Longview, and those facilities, because long term, what you're talking about, can you deny access to those ports and move all of that activity someplace else? So it's not just a Port of Portland issue. It has to do with the ports on the Columbia River, and that's why all the other ports are sponsoring the project. But Astoria was looked at as a part of the analysis, and when you look at the land base that's available, there simply isn't enough land to accommodate anything close to one container terminal in Astoria, short of a massive fill of the estuary, which creates in and of itself a whole series of other environmental questions, which on the surface, when it was looked at, according to people doing the feasibility study, it was not a viable alternative. Besides that, there was not the rail or the road access to accommodate any kind of inland distribution that would be necessary. The case you refer to in Port Westward, while it was looked at, I believe it was it had some of the same dynamics that it had to respond to and deal with. There is, as you pointed out, a plant that's going to go there and use a substantial amount of available land space in this location, from what I understand. And I'm not an expert on that, but I recognize it, that it is taking a substantial portion of available space. But there was an alternatives analysis done as a part of the feasibility project, and the conclusion was that it made more sense to deepen the channel than it did to deal with some of the other questions that I've covered.
Well, Mr. Chair, is that alternatives analysis available?
I'm sure it is. It's a part of the feasibility study that was done, which all the ports participated in.
Another question. I think the governor has very wisely nominated for a position on the Port of Portland a person from outside of the metropolitan area who comes from a part of the river that isn't the Portland metro area. What's your position on that appointment?
You're asking my position? I've not taken a position. I think that's clearly appointing members to boards and commissions is the governor's job. And from my perspective, the governor should appoint, and the legislature should exercise their responsibility to determine if, in fact, those appointees meet the statutory responsibility. And so that's between the governor and you folks.
Then perhaps I asked the question incorrectly, and I would rephrase it. From your perspective as the executive director of the port, do you have an opinion about whether or not having folks from other parts of the river system sit at the Port of Portland table?
The present, Representative Johnson, the present statutory direction that the governor uses today says the governor has the latitude to appoint people from outside of the tri-county area. Two people from each county have to serve. That gives the governor three people who can serve outside of the area. I believe that's a good idea, and I believe it's the governor and the legislature should determine how that should be carried out.
Thanks, Director.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Please, Brent. You want to come up as well? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing today in support of channel deepening for the Columbia River Port System, which we believe is a means of assuring the future viability of that system. Columbia River Port System develops fully $12.5 billion worth of annual waterborne commerce, and both directly and indirectly impacts fully one-third of Oregon's economy, of which 4,500 jobs are represented by Oregon AFL-CIO unions. Those are direct jobs, Mr. Chairman. And we believe that, in addition, if you consider the tertiary and secondary impacts, we have an additional 200% factor on top of that. I would also point out that there are a couple of larger unions within the state of Oregon, namely the Carpenters and the Teamsters, that represent an additional 2,000 workers who are also employed in direct port-related jobs. If you refer to my prepared statement, I break out the sectors that those jobs are in. It's significant to note that the direct employment, which I've just referred to, constitutes family wage jobs. These are jobs that pay in excess of, on average, $40,000 per year, plus a comprehensive benefits package, and I refer specifically to a pension plan and health and welfare plans. Now, the third of the economy, which I've referenced, is threatened, and that's why the Oregon AFL-CIO is before you here today. Threatened by the fact that the Columbia River Channel cannot accommodate today's deep draft trans-Pacific vessels. At the equivalent of approximately $3 million of cargo per foot of vessel draft, we face the very real threat of losing trans-Pacific shipping to other West Coast ports, namely San Francisco, Seattle, Vancouver, British Columbia, et cetera. And this is not something that's speculative, Mr. Chairman. I would refer you to the Oregonian article that's attachment to my prepared statement. Now, deepening this channel can and will be done in an environmentally sound and sensitive manner. Indeed, this has been done every year for the past 20 years at a rate of 5 to 6 million cubic yards of dredge material each and every year in order to maintain the present depth of 40 feet. And this has been accomplished in keeping with the Clean Water Act, with the Endangered Species Act, and the National Environmental Policy Acts. In fact, 99% of the dredge material, according to the Army Corps of Engineers, is coarse gray sand, and our organization supports all environmental studies that we believe are going to reach that very conclusion, that this is coarse gray sand. Capital and commerce are very mobile in today's global marketplace. And, Mr. Chairman, time is of the essence. Time is money in this regard, and we would urge your committee's or subcommittee's approval of channel deepening so that we may get on with this project so that the Columbia River port system retains its competitive position in the shipping markets here on the West Coast, that we retain Trans-Pacific shipping, and that we continue to retain that one-third of our economy which is generated by this waterborne commerce. And I would be happy to attempt to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Brad. Questions? No questions. Thanks, Brad.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to also make my contribution here. I do that on behalf of my wife, who is a cancer survivor.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll pass that along to Representative Bromley.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Zimmer, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm the Northwest Division Manager for Wilbur Ellis Company's Animal Feed Division. I've been with this company for 21 years now. I grew up on a dryland wheat farm in eastern Washington that is still owned and operated by my family. My immediate family lives right up the street from Representative Ringo in District 6. Wilbur Ellis Company has four...
We feel for the rest of your family. He's not here so we can pick on him.
Wilbur Ellis Company has four locations in the Portland area and many locations in eastern Oregon and the Willamette Valley. We have agronomy offices all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. My immediate division has three locations in the Portland area and one in Ogden, Utah. The Northwest Feed Division markets approximately 250,000 tons of various animal feed ingredients per year. Of this 250,000 tons, approximately 50,000 tons is exported. Of that 50,000 tons, approximately 30,000 tons is currently exported through the Port of Portland. Most of that comes from our feed ingredient blending plant in the middle of the Pearl District, of all places. Our hay division, which is a separate division from the Northwest Feed Division, exports straw hay from the Willamette Valley. They help develop the export market that Mr. Thorne was referring to in Asia, thus helping alleviate the field burning problem that once existed in the Willamette Valley as well as Washington County. The hay division and the feed division also ship alfalfa hay and pulses from the Inland Empire and Columbia Basin via barges down the Columbia River destined to various export ports. Our agronomy division ships various products up the Columbia River via barge. Those products come into the Port of Portland via ship. The Northwest Division, the feed division, recently signed a long-term lease on some property between T4 and T5. Our intention was to build a new protein blending facility for exporting feed proteins. It took us 18 months to find a suitable location with the property amenities. Those amenities being proper rail service as far as the UP, the BN, reciprocal switching, ability to install all the proper machinery, et cetera, at a very, very sizable investment. Our intention was to move the export shipments of the new facility near the port to save on drayage costs as well as increase our throughput. We also wanted to move our export commodities that pass through third-party transloaders in Tacoma and Seattle to our own facility in Portland. This would help naturally pay for the new facility, but more importantly to us, we would have much better quality control handling our commodities in-house. Recently, we were advised by Evergreen that they plan to leave Portland by June. They are our largest carrier from Portland. Evergreen says they will not equalize our freight rate difference and pay the freight difference from Portland to Tacoma. We are searching for a new carrier to handle our cargo at competitive rates. We are truly concerned that other carriers will not be able to provide ample space, especially if we construct our new facility. More importantly, we are concerned that rates will not be competitive with other West Coast ports. Freight difference between Portland and Tacoma could cost us $600,000 based on our first year output on this new facility, which is roughly 3,000 TEUs. We have talked to Evergreen, Maersk, Hyundai. The size of the ships that they are bringing into the West Coast Asia service as well as the Columbia River Channel create major concerns. Lack of inbound cargo is also a concern. The Northwest Feed Division for Wilbur Ellis Company was founded in Seattle. We opened our protein plant here in 1950. We do not want to move back to Seattle, but for $600,000 a year in our first year of operation in this new facility, we may not have a choice. I want to thank you again for this opportunity to speak with you, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, no questions. I just have a comment. You must have been there 21 years ago then. It wasn't that long ago, but when I ordered feed from Wilbur Ellis for my hogs in Sherman County, you guys were always wonderful to work with. I would only say at one time there was a truckload of meat meal that came in, and came in late because of mechanical difficulties, and it's the first time I learned what it's like to unload meat meal with a Mormon board. So at 2 a.m., that's not a very good job, but it's not a very good job at any time. But we had
Senator
a great
Carno? It's a smaller world than you think. I worked for Ray Clarno for 3 years.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
You guys are good.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
I didn't know that.
Representative Johnson.
I wanted also noted for the record that our last witness also left a very generous donation for the Cancer Society. Thank you. And you gave acronym-free testimony so that you get extra points.
Well, I better do something right now.
This isn't the committee, it's a shakedown. Yeah.
We're doing well. We've got to have invited testimony more often.
I want to remind the committee that when we first started this, and you remember Senator Yee came in, she thought this was for a party.
She's offered to have the party at her house.
I don't know if she's offered or she's getting forced into
it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mark Hamlin, and I'm serve as president of Local 40 of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union in Portland, Oregon. Local 40 members work in Coos Bay, Newport, Astoria, Kalama, Longview, and Vancouver, as well as Portland. And Representative Johnson stepped out. I would please announce that I'm a resident of Representative Johnson's district. I live in Warren, which is between St. Helens and Scappoose. On behalf of the ILWU, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present our view on this project. We strongly support the project, and we applaud our state's prior financial commitment, and we urge financial reauthorization.
Mark, you can repeat what you just said.
In your absence, Representative Johnson, I made note of the fact that I'm a resident of your district and pleased to be, and we're almost neighbors.
I'm well aware of that. Thank you, sir.
We have been watching the evolution of this project for up to 11 years now, and, you know, I work with a lot of people that get dirty on the job, and frankly, they're concerned, and a lot of people wonder that if we just continue to scrutinize and study and litigate this project, if we won't sooner see a Major League Baseball team in Portland before the completion of this project. And baseball's been around a long time, but those of us who work on the waterfront realize that the waterfront for us is a lot more profitable. We have played a part in similar projects up and down the West Coast, most recently in Oakland, California, and in Coos Bay. And in Coos Bay, I spent 4 years as a port commissioner there, experiencing many of the same problems and issues that this project is confronted with today. And while our jobs hinge on the completion of channel deepening projects, the ILWU does not take the process lightly. We believe environmental laws and concerns should be lawfully and rightfully addressed, and at this time we believe they have been. Lord Bowen once said that a metaphysician is a man who goes into a dark cellar at midnight without a light to look for a black cat that is not there. And sometimes those of us in labor view those critical to this project, and to paraphrase, as going into a dark cellar at midnight without a light to look for a black cat that is not there and identifying one anyway. Many of these questions are legitimate, but frankly, we don't feel others are not. We reject the premise suggesting that in any event, any single entity cannot recognize a direct economic benefit that the project may legitimately be opposed. And we look forward to the issuance of a new biological opinion next year. We concede that no labor force or union possesses more self-interest in this project than the ILWU. We work from Bellingham to San Diego. We work in Los Angeles, and we work in Seattle. We can travel to other ports, or we can transfer permanently to other ports. But we are Oregonians. We value our quality of life, and we believe this project protects our quality of life environmentally and economically. For those of us in Portland, our economic future rests in the successful completion of this project. There are 600 ILWU members in Portland alone. Those 600 families represent $49 million in yearly income. We have excellent health insurance, and we pay good taxes. For a number of reasons, Oregon's smaller ports are suffering. ILWU members from Coos Bay, Newport, and Astoria travel frequently to Portland to work. They take those dollars back to those local economies. This is not a Portland issue. This is a state issue, and it's a regional issue. Recently, Secretary of Transportation Minotta testified before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and he said in written testimony, and I quote, "Our marine transportation system is one of the nation's vital links with about 90% of our international trade and a significant portion of domestic trade carried by water. International trade is an essential component in the growth of the U.S. economy, but it is already creating severe congestion at our ports and on our highways, and the volume is expected to double by the year 2020. We believe the Port of Portland's future is bright. We have space to expand, and because of increasing trade opportunities, we believe ultimately that all of Oregon's ports will benefit from this project. We want to express our appreciation to Governor Kitzhaber for his support, and again, the International Longshoremen Warehouse Union thanks the legislature for its past, and we hope renewed support and commitment for the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project through the 2001-2003 biennium. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Hamlin, any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think next for invited testimony, Keith Levitt and Diane Perry.
state your name for the record, please. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Perry. I'm here today as senior project manager for this project, representing the ports that are the sponsoring ports. I'm jointly funded between the states of Oregon and Washington. On the Washington side, by the sponsoring ports of Port of Longview, Port of Kalama, Port of Vancouver, and Port of Woodland. And on the Oregon side, my sponsors are the Port of St. Helens and the Port of Portland. I came today not with prepared testimony, but really just to answer three questions and then respond to any questions that you all might have. First and foremost, to briefly describe the project in terms of where it is today and kind of put it in perspective. Secondly, to spend a few minutes talking about where are we in terms of getting to completion of the project. It's a bi-state and federal project, and we have a series of milestones that we have to meet in order to get to completion. And then finally, to talk about the process that we're in right now in terms of answering the environmental questions. There's an unusual and interesting, and we hope, process that will answer all of the questions that have been raised about the project from an environmental standpoint. So with that in mind, I understand we have just a few minutes, and so I'll briefly go through these points. First of all, when you talk about the Columbia River Navigation Channel as it exists today, in a river that's roughly from 2,000 feet wide to 4 to 5 miles wide at the estuary, the actual navigation channel is only 600 feet wide and 40 feet deep. So when we talk about deepening the navigation channel, when you consider the width of the river and the fact that the channel exists, and then you look at the bottom of it, it's a very active environment. There's a lot of flow in the Columbia River. So the bottom is always moving with a series of sand waves, just as you see on the beach. When you look at the cross-section of the river and talk about what we're talking about today, we're talking about taking off the tops of those sand waves. The actual project at this point in time involves only the Columbia River. The Willamette has been delayed because of the Superfund listing, and any construction on the Willamette would happen at some point in the future, assuming there is a cleanup plan and those pieces can be integrated. So we're only here today talking about 106 miles on the Columbia River. As it stands, construction on the Columbia River basically yields a 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio for construction of this project. The Corps of Engineers conducted a 5-year feasibility study that looked at both the environmental implications of the project as well as the economics, doing everything from looking at what the future fleet size looks like, what the cargo commodity projections are, what's expected in other ports around the world, and coming up with the 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio. From the standpoint of engineering the project to accommodate environmental concerns from the beginning, the premise was to avoid impacts in the first place, where we couldn't avoid those impacts to minimize them, and where we couldn't do anything else than to mitigate for them. To that end, among the changes that were made in the project over the way the channel is operated today is that the disposal plan for construction of the project moves about 67% of the material upland behind berms. In the past, there's been a practice called beach nourishment where material is dredged and then placed along the beaches. It subsequently, over years, erodes away and then is placed on the beaches again. Or there's what they call flow lane disposal, where material is actually disposed in the flow lanes. For the construction of this project, because of concern with endangered species, the plan actually shifts so that disposal occurs upland behind berms for 67% of the material that would be dredged for construction. That's basically about 19 million cubic yards total that it would take to construct the project. When you look at the amount of maintenance dredging that occurs today simply to maintain the 40-foot project, we remove 5 to 6 million cubic yards per year of material as it stands. So the construction of the project equals about 3 years worth of maintenance. Over time, because of this shift in disposal practices, about 26 million cubic yards less material would have to be dredged over the life of the project. We would see maintenance go to 4 to 5 million cubic yards per year. And so the intent, both from the standpoint of concern about any stranding or warming of the water, as well as the long-term less impact on the environment, the intent of the actual design was to reduce the impact on the environment.
There were wetland areas that were identified as being impacted, about 20 acres of wetland, 67 acres of riparian habitat, 200 acres of agricultural land will be impacted by the project. That is mitigated for by about 736 acres that would be put into permanent green space and managed for wildlife protection. In addition to that, the sponsors started looking around the country about midway through the feasibility study, looking for opportunities where dredge material had been used beneficially, and in particular focused on the Houston-Galveston channel and the work that they had done there, where they were taking dredge material and basically putting it, establishing it in a way where seagrasses could be planted, and they were restoring saltland marshes. We came back and asked the Corps of Engineers to work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries Service, Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife, DEQ and DOE, and study and see, are there opportunities to beneficially use the material here? They came up with a number of projects that are referred to in the project now as the ecosystem restoration components. It's about $5.6 million worth of ecosystem restoration that encompasses three things. One, it would restore, as Brad Witt mentioned earlier, access to about 38 miles of spawning streams by putting fish gates within tide gates. The second component is the restoration of water flow to about 1,250 acres at Shillipoo Lake. That's next to the Vancouver Wildlife Refuge, and the water flow, the dikes would be breached and water flow would be restored to that area. It would be managed for wildlife. And the third component is what's called embayment circulation restoration. And it's areas in the river where dredging has occurred over time and it's eroded away, so it's shallow. Fish can get in there but perhaps can't get out, or the water warms. And so the intent is to restore the circulation in a way that it protects small fish. Those were the three components that we were able to get recommendations for from the wildlife agencies. So that briefly describes the project. The second piece I wanted to talk about is what does it take to complete this project? What are the steps that we have to go through? First and foremost, we needed to complete a feasibility study, and the Corps of Engineers had to find that it was in the national interest for the project to go forward. They came up with a 1.9-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio for the project and estimated that over time, the annual transportation cost savings to the region and the nation is $34.4 million. And that's an estimate that is, from our point of view, a very conservative estimate, but it takes into account four commodities, wheat, corn, barley, and containers, and then looks at the transportation benefits over time. The ports have done other economic studies and identified in Oregon, for instance, a $1 billion personal income estimate in terms of the implications of trade for the region. We've looked at job impacts for all of the sponsoring ports and the beneficial impacts there, and some of those figures are in the testimony that I gave you. But anyway, moving from the feasibility study, we have to have a positive recommendation from the Corps. We have to have an authorization from Congress. We have to have a positive chief's report from the Corps of Engineers. We need to get a biological opinion from the National Marine Fisheries Service that is favorable to the project. We have to have certifications, Clean Water Act and coastal zone consistency determinations from the states of Oregon and Washington. We have to secure the disposal sites. We have to enter into an agreement with the Corps of Engineers for the life of the project that will be in terms of what our sponsor responsibilities are. And then finally, we have to get what's called a record of decision from the Corps of Engineers. It's the final legal step they take to authorize the project, and then it can go forward. So those are the steps. We do have an authorization. The project's been authorized. The feasibility study's completed. We have a positive chief's report. We had a biological opinion, and in August of last year, that was withdrawn by National Marine Fisheries in order to reevaluate some information, reevaluate their position on the project based on new information they had received. That process has led to a reconsultation, which is going on right now. And I'd like to take a few minutes just to talk about that, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have. The Corps of Engineers, National Marine Fisheries Service, and now U.S. Fish and Wildlife, because they are responsible for two of the listed species on the Lower Columbia River, are engaged in a reconsultation process. The ports are participating in that as the designated non-federal representative for the Corps of Engineers. What we have done as a group is, first of all, to work together to commit to trying to work our way through this process on a timeline. We have hired an outside firm. The name of the firm is the Sustainable Ecosystems Institute. And this is a group, it's a public benefit nonprofit corporation that, in essence, works to solve environmental problems through the use of science. What they do is they convene an independent panel of scientists who come together, and in our case, they're going to come together for a series of meetings about a month apart to consider particular issues of concern around this project and address the best available science standard that is required under the Endangered Species Act. We've started that process. The schedule is included on the first page here of the materials that I gave you. That shows you the schedule and the meetings that we're having. The way this works and the reason that it's independent, even though the Corps of Engineers has hired them, we hired them for the first several months to get them started because it took the Corps 120 days to actually get to the point of contracting. But subsequently, the Corps is actually the contractor, but all four entities help govern the management of the contract. We all have a say in what happens in establishing the meetings. The panel was established by SEI putting forward a list of nationally esteemed scientists. All of us had the opportunity to veto any particular scientist if we felt their work or for one reason or another that they weren't appropriate to the panel. So we all had a veto power, but none of us could select the panelists. As we ultimately ended up with the panel of seven scientists that you see listed at the bottom of the page. That group then meets, as I said, on this monthly schedule. They consider the issues. They hear presentations from the Corps, from National Marine Fisheries Service, from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and from other interested parties if they have science to discuss. This is not a federal or a public process, but it's a science-based review process. The way they describe it is that it's a transparent and open process. It's open for any member of the public to observe. Members of the public can present if they, in fact, have science to present. The panelists will consider the material that's presented and basically have a discussion and give us feedback in terms of what they consider best available science. All of these sessions are videotaped, a record is kept of them, and in addition, the summary of all of the meetings is put up on the internet within 30 days of the conclusion of each of the workshops. And I listed the webpage there for any of you who are interested in visiting the website and keeping up with what's going on with the project. But we've entered into that process because of the concerns that have been expressed throughout the region in terms of the science around the work that the Corps of Engineers had already done. And questions have been raised by downriver communities, by environmentalists, and others. And we want to be sure that we've answered those questions before this project moves forward. I think we all feel strongly enough that it's important to the region that it's done in an environmentally sensitive way, that we've gone about it to be sure that we do answer those questions and that the subsequent biological assessment that moves forward into the formal consultation process answers the issues that are of concern after we've gotten the feedback from this panel and gotten their view of what are really the important scientific issues or maybe where best available stands. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Perry. Any questions? Senator Yee.
Madam Chair. I appreciate your information, but is it possible for you to give us a one-page summary and telling us what has been appropriated during the last 2 years, 3 years, and what you're asking this session, and what is the total investment we are looking at, and let us know how many jobs do you expect this will create, what is the cost per job, and what is the return on investment. And I know you have indicated some figures about a 1 to 1.9 benefit ratio, and if you can tell us what is your methodology in arriving at that answer, and what is your goal for the next 2 years?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the 1.9 to 1 benefit to cost ratio was the result of the Corps of Engineers feasibility study. I'd be happy to try and provide those answers to you in writing.
Yes. we've been asking every agency to give us a performance measure. So we would be happy to give you an example of performance measures we have asked Employment Division to give to us just very recently, so you know what we are asking for in a one-page summary, so we can see exactly what kind of jobs it will create, how much investment we are making, and what kind of return on investment we are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to have a copy of the Employment Division's performance measures?
No, we need to get that from the Employment Department analyst.
Do you mind if we get it from Lori and supply them a copy?
I can make sure that they get a copy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Other questions with Ms. Gray?
Madam Chair, Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. I'm not going to, I know we're out of time just about, and just one quick answer to Senator Yee's question about funding this session compared to last couple of sessions.
Yeah, cumulative total.
Yeah, and we'll get you that in writing. The quick answer is that this is a revenue neutral proposition to the legislature this session. What we are asking you to do is to reauthorize the same amount of dollars net that you did in the last two sessions. It's done in a little different way, and we'll go into details, I'm sure, as this budget progresses. The governor made some switches between real lottery dollars that was appropriated in the past to the bonding amount that's in his budget. But the net result is that it's revenue neutral. This is not an added amount of dollars this session compared to what we've asked in the last session.
Not an added amount of dollars, but it will contribute to the total lottery-backed bonding that the state is doing.
Madam Chair, that is correct. The total amount that we've been asking for two sessions now is $27.7 million, and whether it comes through bonding or through direct lottery, of course, that's up to the legislature. And at the end of last session, the legislature appropriated that amount largely in bonding. In fact, $10 million of it was direct lottery, $17.7 million of it was bonding. This session, the governor has taken some of that direct lottery and put it into the bonding amount, but it's the same amount of money, $27.7 million that we're asking for, and that's the same amount that we're asking the Washington legislature to consider as well.
What's the Washington legislature's contribution to this point?
Madam Chair, we've approached the Washington legislature in the same way. $10 million was appropriated two sessions ago. It was subsequently rescinded by I-695, which passed in the state of Washington and affected a lot of their transportation projects. The $10 million was reappropriated, and this session we're also looking for $17.7 million to equal the $27.7 total. We've requested the same set of conditions on the Washington funding as we have on the Oregon, which is each state needs to match the other, that we need a completed project, we need a record of decision, and a project cooperation agreement before funds would be released.
Representative Smith.
What type of container activity does the Port of Portland have versus the Port of Vancouver?
That's a question that there's probably others that could answer better than me. I mean, the container business, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the container business is more to the Port of Portland than to any of the other sponsoring ports, although I understand Vancouver recently got a container crane.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Port of Portland does all the container operations on the river right now. Port of Vancouver may end up getting into that business in the future.
Any other questions for Ms. Craig?
I have a couple, Ms. Craig. I just want to make sure that I understood you. When you were discussing this very distinguished panel of scientists that were being aggregated to do the analysis or participate in the independent scientific review, you said we had the veto power. Who's we?
Each of the four entities that are involved in the reconsultation process.
So
that would be the Corps of Engineers, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the ports acting as non-federal representatives.
And following along the same line of questioning with this distinguished panel, you said these were all going to be public meetings and the public could present.
How will you provide notice of these meetings, and through what portal can the public come? How would they know that there was an opportunity to present? Will there be a solicitation of papers, an opportunity for public testimony? How will you advertise the opportunity?
Madam Chair, the Sustainable Ecosystems Institute has written letters to interested parties or anyone who commented on the project in the past, to environmental groups, to state agencies and others, advised of their role in the of what they're doing in terms of the independent scientific review and inviting people to participate. It is, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a required or like a NEPA process where there's a certain requirement for a series of public hearings. This is, in fact, a transparent process, sort of an environmental mediation process where the public can observe. If the public has science to present, they should contact Sustainable Ecosystems directly, and they've, through the network of people interested in the project, tried to advise of that availability. On the other hand, they're not set up or structured to really consider public testimony in the sense of issue-driven public testimony. Their sole goal is to look at best available science, and so they've written, I think, two letters now to environmental groups, state agencies, and others that have expressed interest in the past. I think that list is now up to maybe 60 to 80 people that they are aware of that have had an interest in the project.
My final question is, when you started your testimony, you said part of what you were going to do was to say, what's the project and where are we in the process? And you went through a very comprehensive explanation of where we are in the process. It's my understanding that the reconsultation was in part the result of lawsuits or threatened lawsuits. And I would assume that you have some kind of an idea that at the end of the reconsultation period and the issuing of another opinion, that there may be additional lawsuits. Can you comment on that in terms of the time that those lawsuits would absorb and what kind of a delay that might put on this project?
Madam Chair, there were lawsuits that were filed in February of 2000. Most of the complaints, in essence, that were before Judge Rothstein in Federal District Court in Seattle have been dismissed, except for one, which is there's the complaint against U.S. Fish and Wildlife's terrestrial opinion has been stayed pending the issuance of biological opinion on this project. We would expect that there will be a renewal of litigation, at least in that instance, and perhaps others, once a biological opinion is issued. At the same time, I would also like to say, for the record, one of the reasons that I think all of the agencies involved were interested in engaging Sustainable Ecosystems Institute is they have, for the last 5 years, worked in the Headwaters case in Northern California, where there was actually much more controversy than there is around this project, in that people were, there was physical harm to people, and it was a very controversial situation. And they have worked with the parties, the environmental community, the agencies, the members of the community, and others to the point that the controversy seems to have ended, the physical confrontations have ended. They've worked out a habitat management plan. There has been no subsequent litigation in that instance because they so thoroughly worked to address the public concerns and environmental concerns. That was one of the reasons, one of the features that was attractive to the parties in this instance, because we want to so thoroughly answer the questions that it's our hope that there won't be a basis for concern, assuming that the project gets a positive biological opinion and moves forward.
I was very gratified to hear you say that Eco Northwest had worked with Ecosystems Institute, had worked with the community. What's the plan for this engagement to work with the community?
We don't have a final plan yet for that part. The first part of their work has been to get the scientific panel moving and to organize the work in terms of assuring that technical papers and material has gotten to the scientists and that the workshops are put together. And they've only been engaged for a few months, I guess probably since January.
But subsequently, I know that Sustainable Ecosystems has made themselves available to meet with interested members of the public and are willing to meet with environmental groups or others to answer questions or meet concerns.
Through what through what venue was that availability made known?
Through the letters that I mentioned earlier, okay. The outreach that they've started.
Let me tell you what's occasioning my questions. Within the last couple of days, I have gotten a flurry of phone calls from constituents who live up in the Klatskanai area where land acquisition is beginning to take place. And these are largely farmers involved in agriculture who seem to be quite unaware of the fact that property was going to begin to be acquired. And they're raising questions about the costs or the prices that are being paid for agricultural land to turn it into mitigation sites. That's a concern to me, given that at least the acquisition piece for dredge spoil disposal sites seems to come as new news to a lot of these folks. I would be very interested in seeing what kind of a public outreach program is in place at this juncture. All along the river to make people who may not be immersed in the political process aware of what's going on. And maybe you can respond to that now, and maybe you have some kind of a public involvement process paper or something that you could make available to the committee.
Madam Chair, with regard to the land acquisition in particular, The proposed sites were identified by the Corps of Engineers as a part of their feasibility study. All of the landowners were contacted over time. Public hearings were held over the life of the feasibility study. Subsequently, each of the ports involved in the requirement to basically acquire disposal sites held commission meetings and got approval to proceed with the land acquisition program. It was covered by the media at that time, probably not beyond that. But the certainly the landowners over time have been aware, and there have been public meetings around the acquisition. We don't have at this point in time a plan for any further communication around the acquisition of sites. It's required by the federal government. It's required by the Water Resources Development Act of 1996 that sponsors acquire the sites, and it's been a part of this process over the last 5 years. But certainly, I mean, you know, I suppose that we could, if there were interested parties that wanted to know more about it. In the particular instance in your district, the two sites that are under consideration are, first of all, the mitigation site, what's called the Fraser property or Webb District property. That's a mitigation site for the project. And the second piece that's under consideration is the James River site. It's an industrial site that's currently used for disposal. Those are the only two sites that I'm aware of that would be private sites that would be in your district that are currently under consideration.
How much agricultural property did you say was going to be acquired for mitigation?
The Webb property is the primary one.
But in total in your project, how much agricultural land will be impacted?
200 acres of agricultural land is impacted.
Throughout the totality of the project?
That's correct, in terms of being affected by the actual effects of disposal for the project. And that primarily is the Vick property on Puget Island, where Mr. Vick has requested the material be placed on his property.
Maybe rather than taking the whole committee's time, we should get together, because I understand the Fraser site to be 192 acres in and of itself. And I think that perhaps we're saying two entirely different things when we're talking about agricultural impacted land. I would welcome the chance to talk with you again. One other thing that I would renew a request for, and I have asked for this in all sorts of different capacities, as a port commissioner, as a private citizen, and now I guess I'm asking as a legislator. I have yet to see a budget for this project. The last time that you and I talked about this, a stack of material this high arrived in my office, and it was like hunt for it. Somewhere there must be a budget. If ODOT is going to build the I-5217 interchange, there is a work budget that explains the cost of this project, and I have yet to have that document presented anywhere.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to meet with you and maybe better understand what you're asking for. There are public documents around the cost of construction that are part of the feasibility study. Is that the question?
Is there a budget document for this project anywhere?
There's not, Madam Chair, there's not a separate budget document. As part of the feasibility study, there's a section on the cost of the project that outline the cost of the lands, of the actual construction, of the engineering, of the mitigation site. All of that is a part of
land acquisition, of mitigation site creation.
Right. All of that is part of the feasibility study, and I'd be happy to provide those sections to you.
Maybe we provide it to the whole committee. That would be useful.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this witness? Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, I just want to say the Employment Division performance measure is not the same as performance for this project. So I have drawn up a chart that shows we like to see total investment, jobs created, cost per job, return on investment, and cost-benefit ratio on a one-page summary.
Senator Yee, I feel confident that were Chair Butler here, he would appoint you a subcommittee of one to work directly with Ms. Perry, who's probably the most logical person
again
to deal with, and to refine those performance measures, if you'd be willing to do that yet one more time.
Yes. Well, I would appreciate your giving me what you have, and after that, if I have any questions, we can still meet.
Chair. Representative Smith.
I'm not sure how you fully measure the complete impact, because based on what you asked for, Senator, you would also want to look at jobs retained, infrastructure maintained, a decrease in transportation costs as a result of maintaining a deep water port. And so, truly, truly, all due respect, I'm not sure the value of that when this is such a big project, and we could spend years just looking at the economic impact of such a project. And so I'm not sure if I could work with you on your committee to help you develop those performance measures and figure out how do we measure what the true benefit of this is versus the cost.
Right.
I hope I can be your assistant.
Mm-hmm. Well, interested in projected jobs created at this point, and probably we ask them to follow up by monitoring it to see how many jobs are actually created. But at this time, we'd like to know what is the projected jobs created and what kind of benefits will be derived from this project. And I think you already said to us you see a 1 to 1.9 cost-benefit ratio. So like to see what you have now so we can make an informed decision.
Senator Yee, in the absence of Chair Butler, I would expand the committee of one to a committee of two.
Committee of two.
Thank you.
Chris wants to be here.
I'm a great assistant.
Thank you very much, Ms. Perry. Mr. Leavitt, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Keith Leavitt with the Port of Portland, and I just want to offer myself as a resource to the committee. I won't take any more time. We've heard a lot of testimony, and I will be here throughout this the budget hearings on this department's budget, and want to be a resource, and so I'll be following up with our committee of two here to come up with a methodology to determine. There is a lot of information on that issue, and we can definitely do that.
But I would appreciate what you have to give to us first as a start, and then if we need to refine it, we'll work it out together.
Is that all, Mr. Leavitt?
That is it.
Any questions for Mr. Leavitt? Thank you very much. Given, Robin, that we're right now holding public hearings, is it appropriate to invite anyone else who might be in the audience who is interested in providing public testimony to come forward? Being that there are none, that concludes the list of invited witnesses. And is there anything else that, for the good of the order, that the committee should know?
No, Madam Chair, I think that completes today's agenda.
Thank you. With the agenda completed, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Hold on.